Greetings from Albert Park. This is F1 Weekly Familiar member Jason Bentley, the original JB. The red lights are about to go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Here we go!
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 1037, April 1st, 2024. Nasser.
Thank you, sir. Today we have a fully loaded Vegemite sandwich. Sainz Jr. singing, "Under My Thumb, Change Has Come." I say thumbs up to Albert Park and members of F1 Weekly Familia. Malone delivers a three-pointer. Toto needs a vacation in Africa. And at last, Machismo gets the Isaac Hayes CD. We shall explain gladly. Back to you, sir.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, every time Sainz wins, Russell crashes. LCH says, "Out in Q2, I'm used to it, man. It's all cool." Logan Sargeant castrated in Australia. And Fernando's penalty. Over the top, says Spanish FIA official. And F1 Weekly also attended the Good Guys Rod and Custom Car Show in Pleasanton, California. Great show. Highly recommended. Especially for those with an open mind, I want to thank Good Guys for inviting F1Weekly.com, and I want to thank Dan Gentile for his photographic genius. And this week's interview, F1 Weekly Familia member, Jason, the original J.B. Bentley, of course, with Nasser Hamid. So many stories to come in this podcast, so we'll have to wait for that. And I do have to remind everybody, as I always do, that we do need your contribution to keep this program alive and on the servers. So please, we beg you, a click, support F1 Weekly helps everybody stay in business. Nas, I know it's been a long, long journey. Welcome back to America. Welcome to the studio. How you doing?
Thank you, sir. I am back in the USSA. And yes, the long-haul party in Albert Park is over. I am doing very good. Thanks again. But here is the problem. My sleeping hours have turned into like blocks of 3 to 4 hours. So I'm sleeping, waking up. But I think this will all come out in the wash by the end of this week. And we will be back to normal timing. How are things on the left coast? I understand getting very lefty as we approach November.
Thank you, Nasser, and thank you, Gavin. We appreciate the leftiness. Everything is wonderful and normal out here in California, sir. Really, the beautiful state of the United States that it is. But no, I do want to apologize, everybody. We did take a week off. We missed a week, and that's because there was lots of activities in Nasser's schedule, and we just could not make it happen. So there you go. No, everything's wonderful. We have Japan this weekend because that lull. I mean, when there's no F1, I try to watch LuneScar, Xfinity. And it's just impossible. It's just so goofy. It's like watching cars running around at the county fair with everybody eating a corn dog.
It's impossible. Tell the sun to leave the sky, it's just impossible.
You know, some young driver, like he's not even 18 years old, he made a comment, which I was reading today. This kid's name is Connor Zilich, and he's doing a very good job at his young age. He said, after going to a Formula One race, going to a NASCAR event is like a country fair. Now, he did not clarify country fair in California or a country fair in Paducah County, Kentucky. But, you know, to each his own. So, Mr. Rogers, you were talking about Japan, and we need to go back to Land Down Under, Australia, which is very big, but we covered a lot of ground with members of F1 Weekly Familia. Special thanks to the original JB, Jason Bentley, and Familia members from the other side of Australia, Perth, Dave and Katrina Walton. Always a great pleasure to meet passionate fans of Formula One who are also knowledgeable and interested in other series, as we are here at F1 Weekly. Now, last podcast, we talked about a trip to Bathurst, Mount Panorama Circuit. Today, later in the show, we have a reportage from the track by Mr. Bentley. Before I forget, if anybody goes to Australia, which is a fantastic place, great people, lot to see, the kangaroos are wonderful, and especially their leap is very impressive, but there is a strong recommendation. Please do try the avocado, I think it's called smashed avocado, I believe, breakfast with eggs. It's very good, and Mr. Bentley calls it Aussie guacamole. Very, very tasty. So, sir, from Bathurst, which, you know, I've known about this race and circuit before my interest began in Formula One, courtesy to Castrol Racing magazines that my uncle used to bring for me and my brother, and he worked at Castrol for many years. So it was very nice to see there, and has held a lot of great races. And, you know, some years ago, if you recall, Darrell Waltrip and Fox Sports sent a big team there, and they covered that race, which was very well received here in the U.S. So I was very happy to be there. From there, we took a trip to Longford. This is a small town in Tasmania that had a street circuit that was more like Reims in France and Pescara in Italy. In other words, not like today's street circuits in Concrete Canyon. To be honest with you, I have no interest in circuits like Singapore, and remember the ones they did in the dockyards of Valencia. Monaco is very traditional, and I am told, even though I've never been there, but I am told that the Azerbaijan street circuit in Baku is very impressive. So one day we will check it out. And sir, speaking of California as the best place in USSA, which I totally agree, yours truly is flying on a big old jetliner to California for a week, and I will be landing in San Jose, middle of the month, and my friend Jimbo, and you're welcome if you want to go, we will take a drive, which we used to do regularly every year back in the day. We're going to LBGP, Long Beach Grand Prix, that is. Would you have any interest in coming along for the ride?
Well, unfortunately, Nasser, some of us have to hold down the fort, if you know what I mean. It's best, since my walking days are behind me, to stay and protect the F1 Weekly Palatial Studios.
Yes, sir, I know the feeling. My walking days are numbered too. Okay, going back to Longford, this was a regular stop in the Tasman series, which was run in off-season in days gone by, and many F1 drivers have raced there. In fact, there is a pub along the circuit, which has been in business for over 200 years. And, you know, interestingly, when I went to Daytona 24 Hours earlier this year, and Felipe Nasr gave me a ride to the parking lot, one of his co-drivers, Matt Campbell, was in the back seat with me. And I asked him, which part of the U.S. are you from? And he says, I'm from Australia. So I told him I'm going to Longford. And he told me about this pub there, which in the old days on the upper floors, they had a motel also. So check this out. We walk in, and the guy who is at that bar, he had just started there 5 days ago. He tells us, and you know, picture says a lot more than the words, that Jackie Stewart was there in the morning. So we missed the V-Scott by a few hours, and then he showed me some pictures. And he was kind enough to email me some pictures also, which we will share on F1 Weekly webpage soon. So it was very, very nice. And sir, the reason I went there was when I started following Formula One, or soon after that, I learned Teddy Mayer was at McLaren from the beginning, and that his younger brother Timmy was killed at Longford. So it was a mission to go there someday, and the original JB made that happen in the Australian support vehicle. And we shall be posting some photos and story on Timmy Mayer by next week on our webpage. Timmy's accident happened within walking distance from this pub. An Australian racing legend by the name of Lex Davison actually crashed into the side of the building but survived the accident. He was later unfortunately killed in a different accident. His grandson, Will Davison, is racing in Australian supercars these days, and Mr. Bentley and I saw him sign some autographs up close and personal. And, you know, these people are very busy on race day, so there was no chance to do an interview. And these cars were also in action, and they have no hybrids on board, so they sound like real racing cars. And these are sprint races, sort of like even shorter than 1 hour, so very, very enjoyable. Sir, before we go to the Australian Grand Prix, I want to ask you a question. They had this race when I was out of the country, IndyCar race at Thermal Park in Palm Springs, or whatever it's called, Thermal Park or Thermal something. Did you watch any of that action? Because it's getting a lot of flack from IndyCar fans.
I attempted once again to watch some of this, but it was so embarrassing. I mean, it just looked like amateur hour. Half of the field couldn't get around the first. I mean, it was so bad that I had to change it. And Gilligan's Island actually looked more intellectual than this race.
Wow, that's very impressive, Gilligan's Island. So next time you might want to compare it with Jello Wrestling and see which one is more slippery. Okay, now we go back to the Australian Grand Prix reportage, starting with Colley. This was business as usual, three races so far and three pole position for the Dutch master. Obviously no surprise there. Max's best lap was 1:15.915, sharing the front row with Red Bull was the red Ferrari of recovery man Carlos Sainz Jr. with a time of 1:16.185. Now the interesting thing was, shortly before the race, there were reports that Carlos Sainz, depending on how he feels, may not even take part in the race, and I'm glad he did. Hopefully the competition is catching up and we will have exciting battles throughout the season. But a little bird is in my head is saying, that's irrational exuberance. We will see what Suzuka brings and other tracks. Okay, misery loves company everywhere, Melbourne no exception. Fernando Alonso, Lance Stroll is faster than you in Colley. Machismo was the slowest hombre in Q3 and qualified 10th behind his teammate in 9th. But his BFF was out in Q2, LCH sharing row 6 with Albon. What did you make of the qualifying, sir?
Well, it was typical. I mean, we know Max was going to be on pole, but I was very impressed with the Ferraris. They look fast. I think they've made great progress. And of course, Sainz Jr., I mean, the nurse was changing his dressing before he went out and posted that time. So it was very impressive. I thought Quali was pretty typical. Fernando is not having a good week, and neither is Lewis. And there's a lot of lingering questions. I'm not sure. I mean, now you see Fernando thinking about pushing to go to Red Bull to be with Max. But what happened to hanging out maybe at Aston Martin for a couple more years? I'm not sure what's going on. Or it could be retirement. The beach chair could be coming back out, or camping chair, whichever it may be. So, I don't know. I'm concerned, Nasser, because we had a better Fernando season last year so far.
Yeah, I think he is already sitting in the Mercedes seat and thinking of going to Red Bull. You know, the typical Christian Horner called chaos situation. But, you know, Nando is Nando. Okay, sir, moving forward. At Williams, it was a case of, I shot the sergeant, but I did not shoot the deputy. The numero uno man from Bangkok crashed in free practice too, and his car was done blowed up. He should have enjoyed the Australian Grand Prix from the Bondi Beach. Instead, the team elected to beach his teammate, the only American in the race, Logan Sargeant. And you know, I'll tell you one thing about the Aussie crowd, is when they showed Logan's face on the big screen TV shortly before the race, and they mentioned that Logan has given a seat. They applauded, you know, so that was kind of nice to see. There is still love for Logan Sargeant outside USA also. One driver paying the price for the screw-up of another is not very cool, but given the performances of the two Williams drivers, it is not difficult to understand the decision. The decision turned out to be very wise, as Albon qualified 12th, and as much you and I would like to see Logan do well, do you think he would have qualified on row 6?
No, but it doesn't matter. The psychological implications, the subconscious accepting the fact that, yes, I am Logan Sargeant, I am not that great. And, you know, you just repeat it and repeat it, and guess what? He's convinced. So I was disappointed with Vols. I thought, in the long term, and let's face it, it's a Williams. They didn't score any points. It was all for naught. So I think they lost more than they gained. Even though I understand the argument, but you have to have the big picture. Remember the faith in Logan Sargeant? And all of a sudden, when they were up against the wall, that faith left with Elvis.
Okay. So you think they're treating him like a hound dog?
A double hound dog. He's gone. It's done. Now he's... It's a vote of no confidence. Deep down. Trust me, the subconscious is so connected to these things. It's quite frightening.
Yes, very true. Okay, sir. Now we go to the race. First, a word about getting to the track. This has to be one of the most convenient and easiest access to any track I have ever been to. And this is not a promotional talk here. The tram, which is free of charge, something F1 Weekly appreciates a lot, drops you right in front of Albert Park. And unlike Parco Monza, and you've been there, you don't have to walk over half an hour to get to the Autodrome. And it was over half an hour in my younger days. And you've been there, you know how long it takes to get to the track. Here in Melbourne, you are there in a few minutes. On Friday, there were 128,000 people, and they were proudly announcing that the weekend attendance was in excess of 420,000 people. I think it's the, based on the announcement they made, it's the third most attended Formula One race of all time. I think the number one was British Grand Prix and then the US Grand Prix at Texas, which is very impressive. But pole sitter Mr. Max was short on time in the race. There was a huge uproar when Carlos Sainz Jr. took the lead. The Ferrari was looking very quick, especially in the hands of Carlos Sainz Jr. Very impressive first race after his surgery. Some say Scuderia got a lucky break. I was waiting for a text from Peter Windsor if it was Brembo, Carbon Industries or Hitco, his favorite subject. But since then, Brembo has announced there was no problem with their product. This part of corporate speak I really love. It's never their products. Ferrari did something, so tire got suffered. What do you make of that, sir?
Well, my favorite part is when the term sabotage came up. I always loved the sabot being thrown into the cogs of machinery, but why not? You know, what else is happening? Any white powder laying around? The trail of evidence, folks? It happens. I don't know. How could Brembo not take some responsibility? It's their damn brake system. But on the other hand, I'm sure Adrian Newey maybe had accidentally kicked it when he was kicking the tires in the morning. I don't know. It was a bizarre situation. To be honest, in my time in Formula One, I've seen some discs, brakes explode, but that one was very, very interesting. But this is good for Max. Now he's going to come back really pissed off. And when Max is pissed off, it's another 6 tenths.
Exactly. And you know, speaking of sabotage, reminds me of a comment. This is my favorite comment on sabotage. It was in the early mid-70s when James Hunt was driving for McLaren, headed by Mr. Teddy Mayer from Scranton, Pennsylvania, I believe he was from. And he was a lawyer and he was a very feisty guy. And what had happened, it was at the Long Beach Grand Prix that I think James Hunt's car had a puncture or something, but before he retired, there was a popping sound of some sort, right? And his comment was, "This is sabotage." and it's the work of Ferrari Mafia. These were his exact words. And that popping sound turned out to be that his car has ran over a soda can or a Coke can or something like that. So the conspiracy theory, ex-Toro Rosso, ex-Minardi team, that really should be his home for 2 years. What say you?
It's true, we have to be careful, but Liam also needs to jump on any opportunity, which he had done, needs to do, to stay away from the Nick DeFries syndrome. So, yes, that's always going to be haunting in the background. Nick DeFries, oh my God.
Yeah, you know, since we have Visa in Formula One, it would be a good idea if Michael Andretti buys the Alpine team and they get sponsorship from American Express. Wouldn't that be cool? Okay, sir, now we come to the just mentioned hardest working man in motor racing, Lance Stroll. He was not only the top but also well-behaved dingo for Aston Martin in Australia. He out-qualified his teammate and finished sixth. Which brings us to his teammate, the old man of the sea, a.k.a. El Machismo. According to the stewards, and you said the Spanish media said it was over the top, the penalty? Wow. Why am I not surprised, this kind of statement coming from the Spanish FIA or ASN or whatever. But according to the stewards, and Martin Brundle is very high on this, he was a little naughty on the final lap. Let's hear the surprise verdict from Honorable Judge Mr. Clark Wapner.
Innocent! Innocent! If you have Fernando in front of you, you need to be on guard. I don't think that would have happened to Lewis Hamilton. I don't think that would have happened to Max Verstappen. And don't forget, whenever Russell crashes, Sainz wins. So there's a lot to look at here. I think everybody's jumping to conclusions and they are just simply jealous of Fernando El Machismo.
You know, I love all these stats. When this crashes, this happened, that happens, this happens. And there was also this thing that every time a team has finished first, second in the Australian Grand Prix, they have gone on to win the championship. But I don't think that will be happening this season. Okay, sir, very impressive seventh position taken by Yuki Tsunoda. I think we will see him as teammate to Lance Stroll at Aston Martin in 2026. The team will then have two love childs, one from the team owner with guaranteed lifetime job, and run from the engine supplier. Like Jane, Honda is getting serious and have set up a new engine base in England. Hopefully, 2026 we'll see the grand arrival of Machismo in NASCAR. Can you imagine Alonso winning the Daytona 500? Best part is, he does not have to fly home to Oviedo in Spain to celebrate. There's an Oviedo in Florida not too far from Daytona. Would you like to see your Dios at Daytona?
Sure, Daytona is respectable. Richmond, maybe not. So there's a few races he should do, like the Indy 500. And that's what's so exciting. I mean, Fernando has led the Indy 500. He's won Le Mans. He's already so outstanding. And I really believe that LCH needs to start doing some of that stuff soon so he could catch up to Man of the Sea.
Well, that he did in 2007. That was zinger of the die. But anyway, you know what Nando should do? He should take part in the Chicago Street Race because he does very well when he's racing in between the walls. You know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about. And the underlying, how would you call Chicago? There's a lot of corruption, mafioso types. You know, Fernando could get in there and clean that mess up really fast.
Oh, yes. Him and, all he has to do is bring Flavio and Pat Simmons. Everything will be cleaned up.
Well, don't forget, we need to bring in Nelsino as well.
Oh, he would be the mayor by then.
I think on this time, on this moment in life, Nasser.
Both Haas cars in the points with Nico ahead of K-Mac. Ex-boss Gunther Steiner is the ambassador for the Miami Grand Prix, and I heard a late news, which I did not go into details just now, maybe an hour or so ago, that Gunther Steiner has accepted some sort of a racing position with an Australian racing scene. So we can look into this later.
Fantastic. Gunther Steiner is definitely selling himself out there. He is in the scene. I mean, I bet you there's signs and fans even in Compton, Nasser. And on that note, Nass, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with a lot of goody stuff and some of these messages.
Hi, everyone. This is David Malukas, driver for Dale Coyne Racing with HMD Motorsports, and you are listening to F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial, with the king, the Sultan himself, Nasser Hamid.
Thank you, sir, and we will go back to our trip to Australia and Mr. Jason Bentley. He picked me up from the Sydney airport and we just started driving towards Bathurst, and that's a few hours. I thought it was just outside Sydney, but before we went there to Bathurst, we also stopped at Sydney Motorsports Park, which is a very nice track, and in some years ago it used to hold the MotoGP race in Australia before that event went to Phillip Island. And Bathurst, you know, is a very famous track, and they have this thing called Big Dipper, which is like an extension of the famous corkscrew at Laguna Seca. Great track, and it's a street, you know, street track, so you can drive, and we took a lap there, and that was fantastic. Beautiful scenery. There are also areas where you can just get off the car. Of course, not during the race. Check out the scenery there. And Bathurst being in Australia, I was talking to Jason and I said, you know, a kangaroo ran in front of a race car a few years ago. And within maybe 30 seconds of me saying that, I see a kangaroo jump on the track, and this poor thing couldn't keep his balance and almost got run over by a car. But then this creature gets up. And instead of getting off the track, he's now running and we're following this guy. And when he leaped out of the track, that was very, very impressive. So, Mr. Bentley, I want to thank him again for his time and his drive and his tour and his commentary on this wonderful racing track. So please check it out.
Okay, folks, I am here in Land Down Under and we're going up the mountain with not just any JB, but the original JB, Mr. Jason Bentley. Good to meet you. Are you having a fair dinkum day, sir?
Every day is a good day on the mountain. Thanks for coming, Nasir. Thanks for joining me here.
Yeah, great pleasure, and thank you so much for your Aussie hospitality. Before we do a lap, please give us a brief history of this wonderful circuit, Mount Panorama.
So the Mount Panorama circuit's a public road. It's open all year except when there's events happening, which is half a dozen times a year. And the road itself started off as a tourist drive. So the local mayor wanted to build a racetrack in the 30s. Government wouldn't give him money for it. So he decided, well, I'll bring tourists to the town by making a scenic drive up over the mountain. And he was cunning enough to make sure the scenic drive followed the racetrack that's now Mount Panorama. So that was from the 30s. And here we are, 70, 80, 90 years later. All happening.
Smart guy. Now, I see houses right next to the track. Are they bitching and moaning about noises from race cars?
Do you know what, Nasser? There's a house for sale at the moment on the track. You'll see it as we come down Conrod Straight, the longest straight. So I'll slow down so you can get a phone number and you can put some calls in with your money people and see how you go putting a bid in. And you'll see what the demand is versus the supply.
Very good. And, you know, at F1 Weekly, we have checks with lots of zeros, so that will be no problem. Okay, now, when was the first time you came to this track? And tell us your most favorite moments from the Bathurst 1000.
First time I came to the track was until 2001, so I was well past being a little boy by then who'd grown up watching the Bathurst race on TV. But 2001 I came, and I clearly remember at that race, I was on top of the mountain, and the top of the mountain, it's nearly 600 feet from the top of the mountain, where the top of the track is down here to the straight. And I'm standing in hail, and you can see the straight, pit straight, down the bottom, and I'm looking down on bright sunshine. And that's what the drivers love. It's that contrast of weather, of elevation, of curves. Favourite moment, back in 79, Peter Brock. Did something that no one will ever be able to do. He won the race by six laps. He broke the lap record on the last lap. So that's iconic for me.
Yeah, he's a legendary name. He's like the Richard Petty of Australian racing, you know, king. How many times did he win? I think he is the you told me he's the most successful driver in the Bathurst 1000.
Yeah, that's right. He won Bathurst 1000 nine times. He had 32 starts because there was a period of time in the 80s and 90s where the race was run alongside some of the World Touring Car Championship Series. So, yeah, he had 32 starts, nine wins. However, some of those wins came back in the day when you could run back to the garage when your car failed and swap with your other team, jump in the second car and take over the race in their car, which he had done at least once. So records are made to be broken, but history favours the way some of those records have been built.
Yeah, and so he basically did a Fangio. He also changed cars to win one of his championships. Now, who was second most successful in terms of race wins?
I don't know. Maybe, off the top of my head, probably Craig Lowndes would be up there. Jamie Wincup, they're two most. Jim Richards is another name. He won maybe seven times, probably Jim Richards. So the older drivers have more success because they competed for a lot longer than what the guys do in the modern era.
Now, the sensation from across the water, New Zealand, Shane Van Gisbergen, how many times has he won this race?
He won two times. He lost it once. He was in the pits in the lead of the race before he had his first win. They dropped it off the jacks. Car stalled. Starter motor failed, and he lost that race. So he went on to win the race. He inherited it from Shane. So despite his massive talent, he hasn't got the ticks next to his name.
Back in the day, when I was enjoying cucumbers in Karachi, this race was known as Hardy Ferodu 1000. Whatever happened to them?
They were a company. The Hardy side was involved in construction. The Ferodu side was involved in motor parts. All of the business, though, was centered around mining and manufacturing of asbestos products. So when things became nasty with asbestos poisoning, the company slowly started to dissolve. So after having a long association with the Bathurst naming rights, the company dissolved and slipped away and then became taken over by a series of other naming rights. So yeah, that's effectively what happened. That the lawyers and genuine victims brought about the demise of the Hardy Ferodu as a namesake.
Now here's another Australian success story synonymous with Jack Brabham, Repco. Tell us a little bit about this company, please.
Yeah, the replacement parts company. Australia had a strong manufacturing industry. We're now relying on imports for so many things. So cars, combination of being imported back in the day and being made locally, there was lots of opportunity for other manufacturers to supply parts that either couldn't be sourced from particularly England, also the US, so they were the replacement parts company. Yeah, they've hung around to this day. Change of ownership and different things have happened, but they're still with us.
Kangaroos on racetrack, only in Australia. I remember some years ago one of them joined the track during the Bathurst 1000. Is that a common thing?
It is common, but in this sensitive new age, when it happens, the TV director tends to get in early and he jumps on the kangaroo himself, and it doesn't see the light of day. Very rarely does it happen. It happened recently, a couple of months ago. There was a 12-hour race here. Kangaroo got hit by a Porsche. It accidentally made it to TV, but there were no action replays.
Interesting. Okay, now a very difficult question for you, sir. After this, we are headed to the Formula One race in Albert Park. Who do you think will win the Australian Grand Prix this year? And you can take your time.
I like how good Alonso looks on the podium. I've seen him on the podium. He looks like he belongs up there. If Max doesn't win, it means Max has lost. He can't lose. Let's go for Lando. It's such a technical track. Like, it's hard to overtake. So I think pole is king. Front row's king. If they get through turn one, turn two, turn three, they can generally hold it from there. So I think Max will win. It's not who I want to win, but the era we're in.
Okay, you have two mates in Formula One these days, one going up, one going down. Who is more popular in Australia today, Danny or Piastri?
If you walk into an Australian bar and there's one guy laughing and telling jokes, another guy's checking his phone and making sure everything's set in place for work tomorrow, you're probably going to talk to that guy who's having fun. So you can't go past Danny Rick as a character. Kind of telling that Oscar's managed by Mark Webber. I think they've got fairly similar personalities. They're very serious by Australian standards. But yeah, people know Danny Rick. He's well before Netflix, he was popular.
Yes, and Mark Webber got him out of Alpine to McLaren. Smart move. Question is, did he tell Zach Brown about Piastri saying he's not bad for a number one?
Yeah, Mark's got some issues about who's number one and who's number two.
Okay, you went to the Brooklands racetrack, very historical racetrack in jolly old England. Tell us about your feelings being there, what you like, and your other historical tracks on the bucket list.
Yeah, went to Brooklands last year, and that's a name that if you grow up as a kid reading books and motorsport history, that it's there. It's the beginning of racetracks. And I took the train from London town, and you walk from the train station making your way through the streets to reach what's left of the Brooklands track. So all this housing and industry that surrounds what's left of the track, and then you get in there and you still get the chills and the feels when you see the banking and the extension of the straight that goes back down past the original clubhouse. It's a time of racing that we won't see. Sure, the Paddock Club is it's glamorous and it's exciting, but it doesn't have that English air of sophistication that those tracks back way, way, way back in the day. For historic tracks, well, you have to do the Nürburgring, Spa, but the American tracks too. Because American racing isn't such a big scene outside America, that those historic tracks, they're beautiful. They just don't get them.
You mean NASCAR is not popular here?
I forgot about NASCAR. I'm talking open wheeler. So, yeah, NASCAR here is equally as popular as IndyCar, if that helps you.
You know, speaking of tracks in the United States, if you go there and you're welcome anytime, check out Watkins Glen, Road America, Barber Motorsports Park, of course, Laguna Seca in California. The Austin track is also very nice. Any other tracks you have in mind if you want to visit them in the U.S.?
No, they're the ones. You got to go to the Brickyard too, don't you? You can't go to the U.S. and not go there. Daytona is there as well. But those road courses, they were built with racing, real racing. They're narrow, they're blind. There's no runoff. They're narrow. They're for true races.
Yes, and speaking of Brickyard, just the museum there, which is right now closed for renovation, is worth a visit. It's absolutely incredible. They have the trophy from the victory at Tripoli Grand Prix back in the day. Okay. And also the very first car that won the Indy 500 in 1911. And sir, before we do a lap of this wonderful circuit, Bathurst Mount Panorama Circuit, would you have a message for listeners of F1 Weekly?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks to Clark and Nasir for keeping the dream alive. Well over 1,000 podcasts. I started listening around 2008, 2009, so I was on a catch-up program for a while. But it's so good to get some information from places that are very close to the source, but without being tied to the narrative being written by the minders of motor racing. So whatever you do, always try and find two sides of the story. Don't discount something. Don't automatically believe something. Just follow your own mind, follow your own adventure, and who knows where your path will cross.
Thank you so much, and let's get on the path to the top of the mountain, sir. And we will have commentary on the track from Mr. Bentley.
Yes, you're
one
ready.
Moment, please. I am ready, sir. This fine activity is happening in a beautiful Mazda CX-5.
Front-wheel drive, too.
Front-wheel drive, there you go.
We've got 3.8 miles of track. It's 23 corners. If you're at the back of the grid for the start, you're uphill, so it's difficult to get a big old V8 race car off the line if you're down here at the back of the grid. So tighten up the belts. It's a fully open free road to drive on. There's houses, there's some farms, two-way road, and we'll follow the direction that is the right way, which involves more left turns than right turns. But that we
and when there is no racing, this is like a street circuit open. I mean, street open every day for traffic, right?
Right. So we're taking off now from the main straight, the pit straight. There's a guy on a bicycle ahead of us. The elevation, as I said, it's 570 feet. From where we are now to the top of the mountain. So cyclists like to challenge themselves by doing the 4 mile loop. If you're at the front of the grid, which we're coming onto now, it's level, a little bit of an uphill run to the first corner known as Hell Corner. There used to be motorcycle racing here, but that stopped in the 80s because of, naturally enough, safety concerns, because there wasn't the fencing, there's not the runoff, there were trees. And the first corner is known as Hell Corner. And it was known as Hell Corner, not because of the number of crashes there were, but it was because if you came off here, there was a tree stump. And if you're on a motorbike and you take out that tree stump, rumour had it that you were going to hell because you didn't have time to repent your sins before you met the Maker. We're on Mountain Straight now. Mountain Straight itself is more than half a mile, so you're getting speeds up here. Uphill, climbs, and you can see the mountain, but you can't see where the road goes. It's bordered on one side by the infield, where the campers stay during race weekend. Further up, there's houses, and full-length houses both sides. Even a few llamas. So
wow, interesting.
There's all sorts of agriculture here. Will we see a kangaroo? We'll see. Over the rise here, coming up to Griffin's Bend, which is an uphill right-hander. We'll get up there shortly. So much slower when we do it in the Mazda as opposed to the V8 Mustang, but never mind.
And unfortunately, 67 world champion Danny Holm was passed away at this track, so please let us know when we get to that corner.
Yeah, I'll show this, but I had a memory that there was a memorial or a plaque, but I don't know if that was just my poor memory, but I'll point that out. So here we are, coming into Griffin's Bend, which is a tight right-hander. You want to stay low because it's off camber and all the marbles end up on the outside of the corner. So you definitely want to stay in tight and then run wide on the exit of the corner. Named after Mayor Griffin, the brainchild of Mount Panorama, which takes us then up to the cutting, which is steep, to say the least. It's got a 1 in 6 gradient up through here, these left-hand corners. We're getting there. Still climbing, so here we come. 1 in 6 gradient up through here. Lady out walking, doing her afternoon walk uphill. Good for the calves. Beautiful weather here today.
Yes, very nice, I must say.
So into the cutting, because they've cut through the mountain to make the road lower to fit through, like you get on any other road, and then through it's called Quarry Corner. Nobody really calls it Quarry Corner, but everybody knows what it is.
You know, with the race cars traveling so fast, I mean, the drivers must be very busy on this track.
Yeah, that's constant, and no sight. So you're constantly trying to just look, you're looking for marshal points, braking points. But back there at Quarry Corner, that's where Dick Johnson in 1980, huge crash. Worth watching, not for any reason other than just to see the difference in safety. There's tow trucks on the track with cars flying past. There's marshals on the track with cars flying past, all around wrecked cars. Coming up now through Silverman Park, on the right, on the outside of the track, all the fan area. It's all camping, no seating, just standing, so very old school. So through Silverman, series of left-handers with dips, stay far out to the right, and there's a spot called the Grate, because right on the edge of the track, there's the Grate, and that's what the drivers always aim for before they hit this left-hander, heading across into McPhillamy Park, and we're now about halfway. We're turn 10. We're halfway around the track, but we've made it to the top of the mountain.
Is there a part of the track where they have what they call in NASCAR, the big one happens?
Yeah, you know what? That's everywhere on this track, because there's so many blind corners. You can have a big one down on Conrod Straight, the main straight, the longest straight, if you have a tyre failure. Going across here at McPhillamy Park, there's all sand out to our right, and if you end up running wide on this left-hander, cars are doing more than 100 mile an hour through here. Get out there a little bit, there's nowhere to go. Bite into the gravel and off you go.
And this is a very nice walkway by the side of the track. Can people be here during the race?
During the race, no one's allowed on the infield. So there's a scenic walkway on the inside of the track across McPhillamy at the very top with a deck observation deck out over the town. And that brings us then to the skyline, which It's called Skyline because that's all you can see from this point. And so we're just looking out to mountains and can see nothing behind us. Called Brock Skyline after Peter Brock when he had his last race here in the V8 series in 1997.
Its scenery is beautiful from the top of the mountain. Very nice.
Yeah, let's drive. The competitors don't get much time. They get from Skyline then to the S's, which leads to the dip. But the S's, naturally, downhill. So steep downhill.
Is this what they call the Big Dipper?
This is the S's, which is separate. So right, left, right.
There we go.
And then at the last right-hander, we've got the Dipper, which is like a miniature version of the Corkscrew, but just drops away so hard to the left. But as soon as you hit the bottom, although you've got more downhill, drivers have stood further down taking photos back up the hill, and they're changing gear, second, third, fourth, driving in a tunnel of left and right, left and right, left and right.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to be given a ride a couple of times at Laguna Seca, and this is really like the Corkscrew. Very, very impressive.
Yeah. Which then, after all this downhill, brings us to the last tight corner, which is called Forrest's Elbow. Called Forrest's Elbow after the motorcycle rider back in, I think it was the 40s. And he would scrape his elbow going around the corner. So Mr. Forrest had the grazed elbow, so that corner became Forrest's Elbow. Even after getting on that corner, it's downhill and open, but you've got to make sure you've got as much speed as possible coming out of that corner, because that's going to affect your speed going down this 1.2 mile straight. So it's very...
From here it's 1.2 miles?
Yeah, to the next corner, and that next corner is taken at about 180 miles an hour. It's the fastest corner in Australia.
And have they ever done any open wheel races here, like Australian Formula Ford or Formula 5000?
Yeah, so there used to be open wheel racing here, but it's a category, I guess around a category 3 FIA track. So the power to weight ratio means they've got to be below a certain power weight ratio. So that knocks out a lot of the open wheel categories. So if they do race here, they have to detune to keep the speeds down, because it's just such a fast track, particularly for cars with aero. We're coming up now to where Denny Holm had his heart attack. It was on this straight. Originally, this was just one long straight, so basically 2 miles long. But in, I think it was around 87, they put a chicane in to try and attract the World Touring Car Championship here. Sadly, Denny had a massive heart attack. He was able to hit the wall on one side, bounce to the other side, and managed to stop the car. But it was around this vicinity here, approaching this right-hander at the end of Conrod Straight. Denny's car stopped and... yeah, he underwent treatment. It's pretty much from what I understand, it was an almost instant heart attack for him.
Now, not the original JB drove a Formula One car here. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, the less original, younger JB, Jenson Button, when he was driving with the Vodafone McLaren team. There was a V8 team sponsored by Vodafone at the same time, so they did a ride swap. They took one of the demonstration cars around the track here, but had to follow a very different line, because the cambers on the road through those corners, effectively they're driving completely offline. They're on the wet weather line for Formula One cars, so we won't be seeing Formula One cars here at speed. So this corner here, the kink, Conrod Straight, because motorbikes used to break their Conrod coming down the straight. Coming down through here, you're going from 185 miles an hour on the straight, on the brakes, all the way back down to 75 miles an hour.
And this is a hotel here, right, by the side?
Right, so this hotel initially started as a residential complex, and they hit some financial problems. And I remember reading in the Sunday paper that they're trying to get people to buy off the plan, and I ummed and ahed and thought, no, I should, but who wants to live in Bathurst? Who wants to be on a racetrack? Kind of went broke, and then Peter Brock got involved as a promoter. Ultimately, it got restarted as a hotel. Local Australian company has taken over management of the hotel. Function centre up the top. Huge hotel. A lot of government offices are located, plus a university. So there's always lots of other things outside race weekend going on. Yeah, I missed my chance doing a bit of Bathurst real estate.
Now, let me ask you a question. Do the room rates skyrocket like crazy on race weekend?
Yeah. And it's a minimum booking, so you've got a 5-night minimum booking over race weekend. And depending on how many occupants you have, in some of the rooms are 2 or 3 bedrooms, but a single room for 5 nights is around $8,000 for the room for 5 nights for 4 people. So you're kind of getting into the Monaco stratosphere to watch Australian race cars. Here we are coming back down onto the end of the straight into Murray's Corner. Murray's Corner, it was called Murray's because a guy, Bill Murray, not that Bill Murray, another Bill Murray, in the 40s, crashed his Hornet there. So that corner got its name. So there's different corners, different names. Not all the corners have names, but we're coming back now past the pits, past one small grandstand. A few extra grandstands get built during race weekend for the Bathurst 1000. And back in the day, now we've got a wall between us and the pits, but back in the day, you just drove in under a tin roof and that was the pits. Back in the day, I'm talking 70s, but yeah, like everything, it's come a long way from now.
And we've come to the end of the lab. Thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you in the USFA soon.
Yeah, it'll be your turn to take me around a track of something just as memorable. So thanks for the ride, NASA.
No, thank you very much. And I would love to take you on a lap of Bristol International Raceway. It's the finest hairpin you can ever find. Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Keep up the good work, JB. NASA.
Okay, sir. Now we go back to Motorsports Mondial, normal stuff we do, covering other series and Formula 2. This was a case of battle for Algiers. Round 3 of the FIA Formula 2 Championship took place over the weekend, same as the Australian Grand Prix in Albert Park, and this was only for the second time in its modern era that they were racing in Australia. They did that last year for the first time. French driver Isaac Hadjar is a Red Bull junior of Algerian descent. He was man of the moment in the Melbourne F2 races, winning both the sprint race on Saturday, at least on the track, and the feature race on Sunday. The sprint race saw two cars driven by Brazilian Gabriel Bortoleto and Spaniard Pepe Marti eliminated after colliding shortly after the 5 lights went out. And we were right there, you know, when this accident happened. On lap 10, Kimi Antonelli spun and was out of the race. This is Toto's golden child. With a lap to go, Dennis Hauger made an impressive pass on the outside to grab third step of the podium from Indian driver Kushmeni. Hauger then hounded Roman Stanek but was unable to take second from the Czech driver by 0.3 second. Argentina's Franco Colapinto, a lot of people are hoping he's the next Carlos Reutemann, if not Fangio. He was fourth, and Japanese Toyota-backed driver Ritomo Miyata was fifth. Then came the law. Hadjar was given a time penalty for causing the opening lap mayhem. Czech driver Roman Stanek inherited his first F2 victory. Dennis Hauger, an ex-Red Bull junior, he was promoted to second. Now we come to the feature race, which normally takes place on Sunday. Hadjar made up for losing the sprint race by winning the feature race from 8th on the grid, which is very impressive, especially in F2. Hadjar is in his second year in Formula 2. He knows he needs a strong championship or multiple race wins this season to avoid Dr. Marco's machete, because I don't think Dr. Marco is going to put any driver in Formula 2 for 3 seasons in a row. Pole sitter Dennis Hauger led from Mercedes star of the future, Kimi Antonelli, at the start. The young Italian has had a lackluster start in his F2 career so far, but I think he will get going very soon. Joshua Dirksen from Paraguay ran out of luck in turn 13 after colliding with Zach O'Sullivan. Kushmani took the lead from Hauger following resumption of action after VSC. Poleman Hauger hits wall of voodoo after changing to medium tires early in the race, and Hadjar pitted for tire change before full safety car was deployed, and that put him in charge. And he, of course, went on to win the race. Paul Aron from Estonia was second, and he has been on the podium in all 3 rounds so far this season. Boy from Barbados, Zane Maloney, who won both the opening races of the season in Bahrain, was third man on the podium. Signor Antonelli finished fourth, and with little more seat time in the all-new F2 car for the season, prospects are good he may live up to the hype that has been part and parcel of his still young career. He is only in his third year, full year of single-seater racing, so progress has been pretty rapid. Completing the top 5 was again Toyota man Ritomo Miyata.
In the championship, Maloney still leads with 62 points, Aaron second with 48, and third is Hauger with 41. Now, one thing I'll say about Dennis Hauger, I'm sure he's a very good driver, but he has been dropped by Red Bull. I don't know what he's trying to prove by staying in F2. He should get a seat in IndyCar racing, and I think he will do very well here, as we have seen with so many drivers who come over from the other side of the pond. Melbourne victory has lifted Hedjar to fourth in the championship with 34 points. Baby sister to Formula 2 is Formula 3. Here, the Scandinavian drivers rule the streets in Melbourne. The Saudi Arabian Grand Prix weekend did not include Formula 3 on the schedule, so round 2 of the championship took place in Melbourne. The 20-lap sprint race on Saturday was closely fought and produced an all-rookie podium. Martinus Stenshon from Norway took the lead on lap 5 from Dutch driver Lawrence van Hopen. Lap 9, van Hopen was demoted to third by Arvid Lindblad. 5 laps later, safety car was on the track after local lad Tommy Smith and Thai Tasana Paul Intrapuvasag, or something like that, collided. Apologies for butchering the name. There was no change among the top three when the track went green. Stenshon went on to take his first taste of success in Formula 3 by 1.6 seconds over Lindblad. Dutchman Lawrence van Hopen took third. Sophia Floors, the only female in the series and member of Alpine Driver Academy, was classified 19th. Stenshon said, and I quote, "It was a really good race. We struggled a bit halfway through, and then the safety car came out, and that really saved us. Happy with the race, and good to be on the top step." End quote. Feature race. Rookie winner was also the theme for the 23-lap feature race on Sunday. This time, Dino Beganovic, young Ferrari Driver Academy suite, scored his maiden F3 victory. He took the lead on lap 14 from pole setter Leo Fornaroli, who is from Italy, and never looked back. His margin of victory was 1.6 seconds. Nicola Todd protege from Sicily, Gabriele Mini, made it 2 Italians on the podium by finishing third. Macau Grand Prix winner Luke Browning was fourth. Charlie Wirtz, son of Alex, was fifth, followed by another second-generation driver, Sebastian Montoya, in sixth. In the championship standing, senior, Luke Browning and Leo Fornaroli are at the top, with both scoring 37 points each. The Italian is winless, but has scored points in each of the 4 races so far. Browning won the feature race in the Bahrain season opener, but has failed to score any points in both the sprint races so far. Mini is third on 32 points, Beganovic is fourth on 28. Lindblad, whom we interviewed last year, winner on F3 debut in the Bahrain sprint race, is fifth with 23 points. Sir, this is my favorite news item of the week. Malone delivers a 3-pointer. John Malone, boss man of Liberty Media, signed a check with lots of zeros, as in $4 million, to buy commercial rights of MotoGP from Spanish organization Dorna, and Dorna will retain about 15% of the shares. The deal is just confirmed, and already there are rumors floating around that we may see a doubleheader featuring a Formula One and MotoGP race together, and that will be the day. And you know, people are now concerned that they will Americanize MotoGP. I don't agree with anything and everything that has happened in the last 10 years in Formula One. Liberty Media has done a tremendous job in taking Formula One to the masses, the washed and unwashed and the global masses. So they've done a tremendous job, and I think they will do a similar thing with MotoGP. And once again, you're never going to please. And I was thinking, you know, this is not the first time an American organization is owning commercial rights. The previous owners, CVC Partners, they were only interested in making money, and who can blame the uber rich for doing that? And they were part of a Citibank. They really could care less about doing anything except making money. So Liberty Media, who is doing a lot, gets flack from certain corners. What say you about MotoGP coming on? By the way, they have to clear the EU antitrust situation, which may not happen. So what say you, senor?
I thought it was interesting. I had no idea they were going after that market, but they got it. It's done, and it will be Americanized, whether you like it or not. And MotoGP is actually very Eurocentric. So there'll be a lot of pissed off people, but that's just the way it is, Nasser.
You know, they have three or four races in Spain. And of course, I don't have a problem as long as the sport is popular and a lot of people come. But I think they're going to put MotoGP in three, four places here in the U.S. You know, at one time we had Laguna Seca, Texas, and Indianapolis. So having three, four MotoGP races, and I love MotoGP from the days of Giacomo Agostini and Kenny Roberts from Modesto, California. So I'm happy, and like you said, people will just have to suck it up that it's now owned by Liberty Media from New York City. Okay, sir, now we move on to Safari Rally. This was the event that got my interest in motorsports going back when it was known as East African Safari Rally and passed through Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda. This year it was Toyota 1-2 led by Kalle Rovanperä from Finlandia. Sir, I know you like Sev Marshall, CBA, and Alpine. Did you watch any of this on TV or YouTube?
I did watch some of it on YouTube. It's very interesting. I kept the watch on all the press releases and the news on the Red Bull content website. So, yeah, very exciting. A lot of activity. Somewhat vintage sounding. I liked it.
Okay, sir, next item, speaking of EU, Comrade Nikita back in orbit. The European Union's General Court has lifted the sanction against him, with the reasoning being that the association criteria that was used to sanction Mazepin required a further link than just his father's relationship to Tavarish Putin. So I like this ruling because there is no need to sanction or bar sports people because of the action of some, you know, guys sitting in comfortable bunker-proof spider hole, whether it's this country or that country. So, do you like this ruling, Senor?
I suppose so. I mean, not really. Deep down, I don't like it. I mean, Putin sleeps on a $50,000 mattress. I don't know.
Yeah, but Nikita Mazepin has nothing to do with this.
Are you sure?
Yeah, what can he have? Putin is not going to talk to some 22-year-old punk from Moscow.
That's true. That's true. I guess you're right, Nasser.
And I'm not saying punk in a negative manner. I'm just, you know, he's a young kid. What has he got to do? So, and he's in racing. So, you know, racing people are not warmongers normally.
I know, but I recently read that Putin needs a few good men to join the army.
Okay. Now we go to Kiwi on a camel ride. McLaren, a team and company founded by a Kiwi, is now wholly owned by the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Bahrain. The new 100% owner of McLaren Group is Mumtalakat. They have bought the remaining shares from other shareholders like TAG Group, which was started by the late Mansoor Oje and Pepito of Formula One's legend of Edmund Fitzgerald, Nicholas Latifi. Nicholas's father's name is Michael Latifi. He is originally from Iran. The good news about this full ownership of a McLaren Group is that Zak Brown's contract has been extended and he will remain their top jockey till 2030. So that is good. And, you know, Zak Brown also gets a lot of flack, but hopefully, you know, McLaren will be winning races in our lifetime and it will be all forgotten. Peace in our lifetime in Monterey County, and this is of interest to you and me too. Settlement has been reached in the lawsuit against Laguna Seca Racetrack from people who live near the track concerning sound of racing cars disturbing the peace of 1% of California's population. And that's the kind of crowd that lives in that part of California anyway. Now, this reminds me of someone who once said about people complaining about aircraft noise near LAX. Did you not see the airport when moving here? Sir, are you happy with the Laguna Seca situation because you're a regular there?
I am. Well, I used to be a regular there. But, of course, this happens every couple of years. We usually win. It's all good. Everybody makes peace. And there's a lot of hugging and loving at Laguna Seca these days. So, not surprised at all.
Yeah, but the improvement they have made at the track, they are very impressive. I was there a year ago. And I really like what they have done. So hopefully we can all go back to major racing at Laguna Seca and not lawsuits. Sir, now we come to probably the most exciting part of my trip to Albert Park. We come to Famous Last Words with Pat Simmons. The original JB and I were strolling in Albert Park and we spotted Mark Webber. He was moving fast, so we could not intercept him.
But we did made a beeline to Pat Simmons. Pat worked with three racing legends before they became mega stars. And listen to these names: Ayrton Senna da Silva, Michael Schumacher, and Fernando Alonso. So we approached him and I asked him, what were the similarities and differences between these drivers? And this is what he had to say.
Firstly, you've got to remember that each one's like a decade apart. So that's a big difference. A decade, well, in anyone's life is quite a lot, but in Formula One, it's like a century. So you can't compare their sort of technical skills and things, because they needed to do different things. But if you look at them as people, they have enormous self-esteem. They just go out there saying, I'm the best, and I'm going to win. And that's true of any great sportsman, I think. So that's where the similarities are.
Were they equally ruthless? Or somebody had the edge?
No, I think they're equally ruthless, because I think that's all part of it. Yeah.
You need that to succeed,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Can I just have a quick photo?
Of course.
Okay.
Have a great weekend.
Finally, my sincere thanks again to members of the F1 Weekly Familia, Louis and Didi in Netherlands, Mr. Brazier and Dr. Farrington in UK, Balraj Dhaliwal in Singapore, Jason Bentley, Dave and Katrina Walton in Australia. I had a great time, wonderful time, and I am very confident that our paths will cross again in the near future. Thank you for listening till we meet again behind palatial studio walls.
Thank you. Good night.